Why don't we open our Bibles to the book of Joshua? And let's open in prayer. Father in heaven, we are so thankful for this book, this little transitional book that takes us from those five books of the Pentateuch to the actual deliverance of your children into the land of promise, the crossing of the Jordan River into the land flowing with milk and honey. We're so thankful that we can look at this little snippet of history tonight and see you in your faithfulness. And this book is such a picture of, such a testimony to your faithfulness. Lord, I pray that we would be encouraged by that, strengthened in our view of who you are and the faithfulness of God that we experience every day. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Book of Joshua. This is the book. This is where the children of Israel finally get to the promised land. This is where they actually inherit the inheritance, right? They're inheriting the inheritance of the promised land. They're going to physically move into the promised land over the Jordan River. We left them for the last 50 chapters. If you take the last, 14 or so chapters of Numbers, the 34 chapters of Deuteronomy, the first couple chapters of Joshua, we've left them for the last 50 chapters right on the east side of the Jordan River. You can see the promised land from there. You can see Jericho from there. And we left them there, and we watched as Deuteronomy went by and et cetera, as we left as far back as Numbers chapter 22, they've been there ready to enter the land. And this book is the book we're going to actually see them do it. And it's kind of an exciting time in the history of the children of Israel. Just to give you a little sweep of history, you're getting tired of this chart already. We're going to be looking at this little tiny sliver of time right here. After the book of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy all took place, really all the bulk of those four books all took place in that 40-year period, really in very short portion of that. Most of that 40 years took place in the book of Numbers. And now we're just after Numbers. And let me kind of zoom in on this this last 1,400 years of B.C. If you start it at about 1,400 B.C. and move forward, you can see the wandering in the book of Numbers took about 40 years. Joshua is just this little tiny sliver of time, just 6 or 7 years. All of the action that takes place in the book of Joshua takes place in 6 or 7 years. How do I know that? Well, there's a real fun little conversation that takes place in Joshua 14. Caleb, they're kind of reminiscing. And Caleb says this. He says, I was 40 years old when Moses sent us as spies into the land. And now behold, the Lord has let me live these 45 years. And behold, now I'm 85 years old. And this is after the conquest of the land. And so you take 45 years, you minus 38 years of wandering in the book of Numbers. 6, 7, 8 years is all it took for the action part of this book of Joshua to take place, where they go into the land, they kind of break the back of the land in the center of the land, take the south, take the north, and kind of the land is theirs. That all happens in a pretty short piece of history. Now Joshua, the person, he lived to 110 years old. Nobody really knows how old he was when he, was sent in and how old he was when he took over for Moses, but I think it's safe to say that Joshua, you could say, was probably the first judge and takes some of the years of the book of Judges before his life ends. But that what we're looking at tonight is going to be something that takes place in a very short period of time. The theme of the book of Joshua, I think, is this. The book of Joshua is a testament to the faithfulness of God. You get to the very end of the book, Joshua's kind of giving his sort of farewell speech to the nation. He says, now behold, today I'm going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. All of them have been fulfilled for you. Not one of them has failed. Faithfulness. It's a testament to the faithfulness of God. And I picked that word testament on purpose. I looked it up, in the thesaurus. It's easy now with Word, right? Just click on it. and I looked at some of its synonyms, and it's a perfect word for what the book of Joshua is. It's evidence of the faithfulness of God. It's a demonstration of the faithfulness of God. It's a tribute to the faithfulness of God. It's a verification of the faithfulness of God, an authentication of the faithfulness of God. It's a reminder of the faithfulness of God. And we're going to see lots of reminders tonight in this book of Joshua, because God didn't want his people to forget who he was. He's the faithful one. He's the covenant keeper. He's delivering on his promise. Everything you're going to see in this book is all about the miraculous promises of God coming true for the people. You get a sense that there's like a new beginning that takes place in the book of Joshua. You get a sense of the newness of this generation. Remember, this is a new generation here on the east side of the Jordan River. That old generation died out during the wandering of the book of Numbers, and this is a new generation. You get a sense of that newness here. You get a sense that they're going to get their own set of experiences, very much like that original generation got their own set of experiences. They're going to have their own sort of Red Sea crossing when they cross the Jordan River. They are going to have a ceremonial, a sort of a new beginning for the nation when they all get circumcised, which hadn't been done for the last 40 years. Jericho's wall is going to fall as they just enter in the land. It's like a first fruits of what God's going to be delivering to them. They head up to Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and they recite the law. Remember, Moses asked them to do that in the book of Deuteronomy. It's like a reconsecration of this new generation. There's an appearance of an angel right at the start saying, I'm here to fight for you guys, with you guys. There's sort of a reconfirmation that this nation is God's nation. That's what this book is all about, that with the faithfulness of God, that God's going to deliver on his promises. And then it's just followed by these supernatural victories. They go into the center of the land, supernatural victory over Jericho, supernatural victory in the south, where miracles attending these victories, supernatural victory in the north. God just gets them in there and bang, 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 they take the land miraculously. Why is that? Because God said he was going to do it that way. I'm going to go in before you, he said. I said a couple of weeks ago in Numbers, they could have done this 40 years ago. God was ready to take them in, but they sinned. You know, there's a verse in the Psalms, I'm a little bit lost right now, is to remember where it is, but God said, for 40 years, I loathed that generation. And that's always just sunk in my heart when I think about that first generation who could have gone in, could have inherited the promised land. And here, 40 years later, there's a new generation. And again, you see the newness of it as you see the book of Joshua unfold. So for an outline of the book really outlines, I think, pretty simply, kind of in half. You could say divide and conquer. You've heard that term, divide and conquer. With Joshua, it's divide and conquer and divide. Divide the land, go in the middle, conquer it, and then divide it up among the 12 tribes. And so the first 12 chapters of the book is really where all the action takes place. The first 12 chapters, the first half of the book, is the conquest of the land. And you can see it kind of lays out like this if you're a real note taker and like detailed outlines. The first 5 chapters are sort of the preparation for the conquest of the land. And then chapters 6-8, sort of the central campaign. They take Ai, Bethel, and Jericho in the central campaign. Then chapters 9 and 10, the southern campaign. They take on about 16, 15, 14 kings in the south, wipe them all out. Then chapter 11, the northern campaign, and they go up there and take out another bunch of kings and basically have the land. And then in chapter 12, Joshua summarizes. He says, these are all the kings we took out. And he just makes a summary list. Chapters 1-12, the conquest of the land. That's where all the action takes place. And then the rest of the book, 13 through 22 is dividing. That's why I said divide, conquer, and divide. Here's all the geographic boundaries. You know, this tribe gets this area here. This tribe gets this area. I'll show you a map in a bit. They uh, they divide the land. It's all the geography. It's a big geography lesson. Chapters 13 through 22. What are the cities that the Levites are going to live in? Where are the cities of refuge going to be located? What is the land going to look like once it's divided? That's what chapters 13 through 22 are. Then the last couple of chapters, 23 and 24, Joshua just gives sort of a final speech, kind of a going away speech, a speech of encouragement. So let me just take this in order, and we're going to just kind of march through this outline in pretty broad strokes. First of all, let me just kind of give you a little geography as to where we left them, and pretty common view of the Holy Land. I drew in those two rivers, the Arnon and the Jabbok, because if you're like me and you've read a lot of Old Testament, you keep hearing about these two rivers. Where are these two rivers? Well, that's where they are. And it helps you know what they took, what they didn't take, where they were, where they wouldn't, where they weren't. And the people are right now, or the people before the book of Joshua, way back in the book of Numbers, took the east side of the Jordan. The authors call it the Transjordan. They took all that area on the right-hand side of the river. Remember, it says they wiped out these two kings, Og and Sihon, the area of Bashan, the area of Heshbon. They own this part of the Holy Land already on the right-hand side. And remember, Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh say, "Hey, Moses, can we stay here? Lots of land, we got lots of cattle. We'll stay on the east side. You guys go ahead and take the west side. We'll stay here." Moses says, "No, wait a minute, not so fast. You can have this stuff on the right-hand side, the Transjordan, the east side of the river. But first, you got to come with us into the land and help us take the land. Then you can go back over." And it's always sat wrong with me when I saw that little, and when you read it, you won't miss it. When you see that little transaction take place, you kind of go, "I don't know, you know?" And you start looking at the numbers. If you add up Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh, it's about 110,000 warriors. Only 40,000 go into the land with Joshua to help them take the land. That tells you something right there. You get into the book of Judges, and Deborah is, it's during the time of Deborah, and she's kind of trying to muster troops from all the tribes, and she sort of laments that Reuben's people are back there with the flocks. And you kind of just go, "I'm not so sure this Transjordan idea was such a great idea, but I'm not one to, it's not my place to say that." Anyway, we left them right there in that little blob called the Plains of Moab. And Gary, last week when he ran us through Deuteronomy, he called it the Sermon on the Plains, because that's where they are. They're right there. They're on the east side of the Jordan River. You can see Jericho across the way. I mean, you can see it. It's like right there, maybe 8 miles across the river, maybe as much as 12 miles. And they're ready. They're ready. And so here, I kind of blew up that area now, drew in the river for you. And here they are, and they cross the river in the first 5 chapters of the book, and they move into this place called Gilgal. And Gilgal is very close to Jericho, and Gilgal becomes Joshua's temporary headquarters. And you'll see they're always kind of returning to Gilgal after these battles. Gilgal kind of becomes sort of temporary headquarters. Another interesting thing is it tells us when they cross the Jordan River, and it stopped as far up as a place called Adam. I've always loved that, because someone else kind of stopped our entrance into heaven as far back as Adam. And that's a pretty cool thought, isn't it? We're going to celebrate that tonight at the table. That's where the river stopped, up there at Adam. It's right at the end of the Jabbok River, by the way. And they go into the land, the first 5 chapters. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens in these first 5 chapters, in fact, in the first week of the book of Joshua, that are just kind of blockbuster events. The first, in chapter 1, verse 5, we see Joshua is set up as the new Moses, and the word goes out to the people that everything that I did, I used to, God speaking, everything I used to do through Moses, I'm going to now do through Joshua. Joshua becomes the new leader of this nation as early as chapter 1, verse 5. Chapter 2, verse 1, they send spies into the land. Remember, they send a couple of spies to the city of Jericho to kind of spy it out, to see what it's going to look like. Chapter 2, verse 9, they're in Jericho, and they're talking to this lady by the name of Rahab. Remember, Rahab is sort of spared in Jericho. And Rahab tells them, look, the whole countryside is demoralized because of you guys. And I've always pictured them they didn't have binoculars back then, but I always picture them in Jericho like, that's them all right. Look at all of them. Can you just imagine, you know, you're in Jericho, you're looking across the river. Those are the people that came out of Egypt, and the Red Sea dried up, and all of the Egyptian army was drowned. Those are the people that took Bashan and Og. Oh, man, look at them. And she says that to him. She says that to the spies. The whole countryside is demoralized because of you guys. And it's like, wait till you see the river dry up. You haven't seen anything yet. You know what I mean? I mean, they are demoralized. You get to chapter 3, verse 14. They cross the Red Sea. It dries up. They cross it on dry ground. Same kind of wording that's used of the Red Sea cross. They cross the Jordan River. They cross the Jordan River. Same kind of wording that's used of the Red Sea. They crossed over on dry ground. After they get over there, chapter 4, verse 1, Joshua says, take some stones out of the riverbed, dry ground, out of the middle of the river, and set up this pile of stones. Why? Because he wanted a reminder. God wanted a reminder of what he did here at the river. And it even says there, it says, your kids in the future are going to say, Dad, what is this pile of stones? This is where God dried up the Jordan River, and we crossed over on dry land, just like they did back in the days of Egypt. It's just very dramatic, a reminder God wanted them to have. Chapter 5, verse 2, all in the same week. Chapter 5, verse 2, they get circumcised. Joshua says, you know what? Circumcision has fallen on hard times. There's been no circumcisions in Israel for the past 40 years during this time of the wandering in Israel. You guys need to rededicate yourself. You guys need to re-identify yourselves as God's people. So they circumcised all the men right there in Gilgal after they'd crossed the river. Chapter 5, verse 10, a few verses later, what do? They celebrate the Passover, the first Passover in the Promised Land. That hadn't been celebrated for the past 40 years. You can just see it, can't you? New experiences. These are all new experiences for this new generation that God is delivering on his promises. And they're entering the land. They all get circumcised. They all celebrate the Passover. The next day, they're eating of the fruits of the land flowing with the milk and honey, and the manna stops. That's a miraculous ending of a miracle. The manna had been provided every single day for the last 40 years, but the minute they taste of the fruit of this land flowing with milk and honey on the west side of the river now, the manna stops. And then chapter 5, verse 13, this angel of the Lord appears to Joshua, and it's a remove your shoes, you're standing on holy ground experience, just like Moses had, now Joshua has. It's the angel of the Lord, and he's there to fight for his nation. It's all set up to remind the people that this is going to be a work of the faithfulness of God. This all happens in the first week. And then they go for what we call the central campaign. They leave Gilgal, and they walk around Jericho, remember? Absolutely miraculous taking of Jericho. All they're asked to do is walk around Jericho and toot the horn, right? And after 7 days, yell. And Jericho, like the toughest city in the Promised Land, kind of the entry city, the kind of the gateway city, falls miraculously. A kind of a passive victory that God completely wins for them. They'd just seen the angel of the Lord a few days earlier, and he said, I'm fighting for you guys, with you guys. And they take Jericho miraculously. Their first mistake takes place. They go up to take this place called Ai. Ai, it's spelled Ai. Bethel city right next door, in Joshua 8, they make their first mistake here. Do you remember the story? They get a little bit puffed up. Oh boy, are we not susceptible to this as sinners? They get a little puffed up and they say to Joshua, the men say to Joshua, you know, Ai is small, Jericho is a piece of cake, just send a few of us up, we'll take it out, it'd be nothing to it. They go up there and they get chased away and some of their people die. Well, it ends up that when they had taken Jericho, Jericho being the first city in the land, being the first fruits of God's deliverance into the land, God said, look, the spoils you take from Jericho are dedicated to me. They're dedicated. They're under the ban. You guys don't get them. They're dedicated to me. But this guy named Achan, remember, had stolen some stuff, stole some gold and something else, hid it in his tent. God exposes him. Achan and his family are taken and stoned to death by the people. Then God says, now go take Ai. And they go up and take Ai and Bethel. The center of the land has been broken. Some military strategist types have kind of described this as sort of breaking the back of the land. They go in the center and kind of cut off routes between the south and the north by taking Jericho, Ai, and Bethel. They've broken the back of the land. Interestingly enough, after they stone Achan to death, they name the place the Valley of Achor, the Valley of Trouble. And it's another reminder that God wants for them. Dad, why is this place called the Valley of Trouble? Let me tell you, when we first came into the land, God said, you obey me and things are going to go well. You don't obey me and things aren't going to go well. We didn't obey him, and that's what this valley is named after. Isn't that great? Right at the start, God making it crystal clear, this is what you're going to do if you want to successfully take this land. Okay, so they're done. They've taken Jericho, Ai, and Bethel, and then they do an interesting thing. They march directly north to these two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. They march to Mount Ebal and Gerizim to dedicate themselves to the Lord, Joshua chapter 8. This was asked of them back in the book of Deuteronomy. Moses had said, look, when you go into the land, I want you to take half the tribe, stand on Mount Gerizim. I want to take half the tribe, stand on Mount Ebal. And this group recites all the blessings of the law, and this group recites all the cursings of the law. Then I want you to take some stones and write the law of the Lord on these stones at these two mountains. And that's the first thing they do once they've broken the back of the land, is they go and obediently follow that. And it's another reminder, Dad, what are these rocks? This is where Moses told us to go and write down the law of the Lord that we have promised to follow. And here they are at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, another reminder left behind. Now, it's just sort of a parenthesis. I want to stop here for 2 seconds and think a little bit about, you know, when they take Ai especially, it says, they killed everything, everybody, everything that breathes. They killed them all. And people have trouble with that. And so I thought it needs to be addressed. Something should be said about this Deuteronomy 20 is where God said this. So I think 3 things need to be said about this utter destruction of the land that they're supposed to do when they move in. The first thing we should note is it's not Joshua's idea, it's God's idea. It's God's idea. He said back in Deuteronomy 20, only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. But you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. That's the first thing. It's not Joshua's idea, it's God's idea. The second thing is, this is not an isolated biblical theme. This wasn't just for the book of Joshua, just for the initial taking of the land. No, God did not want his people polluted with the immorality and the idol worship of the land. And he already demonstrated back in the little issue of Peor. Remember that? Numbers 25, right after the Balaam and Balak story. Balaam wasn't done. He goes later and gives advice to the Moabites to say, I'll tell you what, if you can't get them with blessings and cursings from the mountaintop, get them with women. And they send women in, and there's a bunch of immorality, remember, and a bunch of people die. That's back in Numbers 25. It's not isolated. God didn't want his people polluted by the land. Clear back as early as Genesis 15, this is way back during the Abrahamic covenant, God said this: in the fourth generation, they will return here. God telling Abraham that his descendants, in the fourth generation, they'll return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. Well, what does he mean? He means that God allows, in his mercy, allows us to kind of, I'll use biblical language, fill up the measure of our guilt. That's used twice in the New Testament. God is patient. I read one author called it the expiration of God's mercy. He's merciful, but he's only merciful for so long. And the iniquity of the Amorite had become full, and they had to be dealt with. Judgment had to fall. Romans 2 says it this way: because of your stubbornness and unrepentant heart, you're storing up wrath for yourself in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God. This was the day of wrath for these people. They had filled up the cup of their iniquity, and God was going to take care of them and take them out. Thirdly, I think when this bothers us, it's because we ask, I think, from a wrong perspective. Our perspective needs to be changed. We talked about this in the men's Bible study on Wednesday morning. We were in Ephesians chapter 2, and it says there, what's it say there? That we were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. What does that mean? The rest of the race. And we ask wrongly when we say, why did God go in and wipe out all those people? We should ask, why did God spare the children of Israel? Why did God spare me? Why did God bring Noah? Why did he put him on the ark? Why does God allow second chances at all? That's how we should ask the question. And the answer is because he's a God of grace and faithfulness and covenant keeping and mercy. And so it shouldn't bother us that when Joshua goes in following the Lord's command, he goes in and thoroughly wipes out the people. That's the central campaign. Now the southern campaign. Well, first of all, these guys in Gibeon, you remember the story in Joshua 9, these guys in Gibeon, hearing about the great defeats, the people of Gibeon deceived Joshua. Remember, they send some guys to Joshua and say, hey, we're in tough shape here. Will you be allies with us? And Joshua says yes. Scripture is actually very clear there to say that, you know, they did not ask the counsel of the Lord. It's probably not a great idea, although God uses it for good. So the children of Israel have allied themselves with Gibeon. And I've zoomed in even closer now. And so all these kings in the south start kind of gathering together. I don't know if you can see those little red lines. The kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Eglon, Lachish, Jarmuth, determined to attack Gibeon after hearing of their alliance with Israel. And this happens in Joshua chapter 10. All these kings out of the south come up to take out Gibeon. And Joshua hears about it. They're allies now. So he sends guys over from Gilgal. The Gibeonites are outnumbered. They ask Joshua for assistance, and Joshua's men march all the way through the night, and there's this miraculous victory. Remember, God sends this hailstorm. It says the hail killed more people than the soldiers killed. And then God stops the sun to allow Joshua more time to cover the ground he needs to cover to have this huge, miraculous victory in the south. Joshua goes down and starts taking out these kings one by one, goes all the way to the south as far as Debir down here. Joshua's army continues defeating not only the guys that allied themselves against Gibeon, but Aijalon, Azekah, Makeda, Libna, I'm wrecking these names, Lachish, Eglon, Hebron, and Debir. Giant victory in the south, Joshua 10, 11, and 12. All these major southern kingdoms have now fallen to the Israelites. That's the southern campaign. Next, the northern campaign. You probably recognize that. It's the Sea of Galilee. We're up north now. What happens up here? Same kind of deal. All these kings get together. All the major kingdoms of the north get together, and they go to this place called Merom. And I'm not going to read all these names. I'll destroy them. But all these kings, from the east, from the west, from the south, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, all these people from the hill country, they came out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. So all these kings, having agreed to meet, came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Joshua hears about it, heads north out of Gilgal, meets them at Merom. And the Lord says to Joshua, don't be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I'll deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses, burn their chariots with fire. So Joshua and all the people of war went with him, came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. And they have another miraculous victory over this army, which is as innumerable as the sand, which is by the seashore. The Lord delivered them into the hands of Israel, so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as these places up north. They struck them until no survivor was left to them. Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses, burned their chariots with fire. Then Joshua turned back at that time, captured Hazor, struck its king with the sword, for Hazor formerly was the head of these kingdoms. They struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying him. There was no one left who breathed, and he burned Hazor with fire. They have taken the land. In the first 12 chapters of the book, they went in the middle, took out Ai, Bethel, Jericho, went south, took out all these kings in the south, went north, took out all these kings in the north, all miraculously provided victories by the Lord, all designated to exalt God and his faithfulness. Hence that theme that I chose for this book. The book of Joshua is a testament to the faithfulness of God. What had God said? I'm going to go in before you, and you're going to take the land. And what had they done? He'd gone in before them, and they took the land. They did it in the first 12 chapters of Joshua. And then Joshua does this great recap in chapter 12, and he says, here's a list of all the kings that you've taken, just like God said he would. Look at this long list, and he just lists them all in chapter 12 of the book, and you get the sense that Joshua is saying now, because the next thing that's going to happen, he's going to start divvying up the real estate, right, between the 12 tribes. The next thing that's supposed to happen is, okay, guys, God has broken the back of the country. He's taken out all the major kingdoms. Go in and finish the job. Take the land that has been allotted to you. And you just get the sense here at the end of chapter 12, go in and take it. Go in and take it. And so that's where we left it. We just did chapters 1 through 12, preparation, central campaign, southern, northern, the summary in chapter 12, and now divide it up. Divide it up. It's a geography lesson, chapters 13 through 22, geography lesson. I've given you a slide because you know me. Slides. The east side, that's land that they had taken as early as the end of the book of Numbers, gets divided up between Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh on the east side of the river. On the west side of the river, this is the way the rest of it, if you take these chapters of Joshua and follow it around, the geography that he's dividing up between the 12 tribes, it looks something like that. That's the land that they're supposed to take. Here it is. Here's all the border lines. Go in and finish the job. That's basically the word that Joshua leaves them as early as chapter 12. But there's an interesting thing that starts to happen in the book of Joshua right after this. I call it the nagging statement. The nagging statement of the book of Joshua. chapter 15, verse 62. Now, as for the Jebusite, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah could not drive them out. So the Jebusites lived with the sons of Judah at Jerusalem until this day. In fact, the Jebusites were so entrenched, you're clear at the end of the book of 2 Samuel, David buys the mountaintop, remember? From a Jebusite. They're still there in David's time. They weren't able to drive the Jebusites out. Chapter 16, verse 10. But they did not drive out the Canaanite who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanite live in the midst of Ephraim to this day. Chapter 17, verse 12. But the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of their cities because of the Canaanite persisted in living in the land. And it came about when the sons of Israel became strong, they put them to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. You get to chapter 1 of the book of Judges, 8 times in 9 verses, they didn't drive these guys out. 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 Is that 8 yet? They didn't drive these guys out. Read it, and you go, what's going on here? Look, the lines are already set. Go in, finish the job. Look what God's been doing. Go in, finish the job. But you get the sense the people didn't finish. It's the setup for the book of Judges. This is what Judges is about, not finishing the job. So here's what the geography should look like. Here's a map of the extent of what they actually controlled, permanently controlled by ancient Israel. And you can see a lot of geography that they never took. And short list, huge areas, many cities were never conquered during Joshua's time. Ekron, Gath, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, Gezer, Makkah, Megiddo, Tanakh, Ablim, Endor, Bethshean. And you read that in Joshua 13, 15, 16, Judges 1, Judges 3. They didn't finish the job. They didn't take the land completely. Well, you get to the end of the book, the last two chapters, chapters 23 and 24, and Joshua is kind of giving them a last charge. If you want to turn with me to chapter 24, the very starting of chapter 24. I've kind of taken a snippet of it, a giant snippet of it, like the first 12 verses, and kind of reduced them down, because Joshua here, as he's kind of closing out the book and leaving some last words with the people, you're going to see in this little speech he gives that he's trying to tell them that, you guys, remember who it is who provided this land to you. And look at what he does here. I kind of highlighted the word I, because it's God speaking. Just listen to what Joshua says in these first 12 verses, 13 verses of chapter 24. Joshua said to all the people, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led him through the land of Canaan and multiplied his descendants. And I gave him Isaac. This is God's plan, people. Clear back from Abraham's time, he's saying. It's been God's plan. I gave him Isaac. To Isaac, I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau, I gave Mount Seir to possess it. Then I sent Moses and Aaron. And I, God, plagued Egypt by what I did in its midst. And afterwards, I brought you out of Egypt. I brought your fathers out of Egypt when they cried out to the Lord. I put darkness between you and the Egyptians and brought the sea upon them and covered them. Your own eyes saw what I did in Egypt. Then I brought you into the land of the Amorite who lives beyond the Jordan. I gave them into your hand and you took possession of their land when I destroyed them before you. Then Balak summoned Balaam to curse you, but I was not willing to listen to Balaam. I delivered you from his hand. Thus I gave the Amorite, Perizzite, Canaanite, Hittite, Girgashite, Hivite, and Jebusite into your hand. Then I sent the hornet before you, and it drove out all the two kings of the Amorites from before you. Not by your sword or your bow, I gave you a land on which you had not labored, and cities which you had not built, and you've lived in them. You're eating of vineyards and olive groves, which you did not plant. Joshua leaving with the people, this reminder, this testimony of the faithfulness of God. People, children, Joshua is saying, who got you this far? God did. Every single thing that you can rehearse in your history, the history of this entire nation, has been a work of the faithful, covenant-keeping, promise-keeping God, and he's accomplished everything he set out to do. Now go in and finish the job. That's the kind of the sense that he's leaving them with. Go in and finish the job. The very end of that, beyond these verses I just put up here, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. Put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it's disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. This book is a testament to the faithfulness of God. I'm going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. All of them have been fulfilled for you. Not one of them has failed. It's a testament to the faithfulness of God. It's a reminder of the faithfulness of God. God does deliver on his promises. I think it's fitting that tonight we're having communion because this book was a testament. It was a reminder. What is this pile of stones for? Why is that valley called that? Why are those words written on those rocks? What's happened here? Joshua, rehearse our history. God did it. God did it. God did it. God did it. And the Lord has left us this table. And what does he call it? Do this in what? Remembrance of me. We're forgetful. We need these reminders. And tonight, we'll celebrate, like I made reference to earlier, what Jesus did. Joshua's deliverance of the people of Israel over the Jordan River, I mean, that's always been, I mean, in songs. I heard this week the song, you're going to really think I've lost it. What's that guy's name? Oh, nuts. People get ready. There's a train a-coming. Remember that song? Train to Jordan. It just made me think, you know, the Jordan River's always been kind of a, in our folklore, kind of a picture of the entrance into heaven, that deliverance into the promised land, that deliverance into the rest of God. And tonight, we're going to celebrate that around the table. Jesus Christ has taken us over the river. We're as good as there. We're seated at the right hand of, we're seated in the heavenly places, it tells us in Ephesians. It's already accomplished it for us. So it's kind of fitting tonight, I think, that we have this little remembrance.